I listen to NHPR because it opens up my world.
Peg Hendel of Waterville Valley is a proud member of NHPR's Leadership Circle.
I really value the fair and well-researched and well-balanced information that I get. That's something I just had to support.
You too can join NHPR's growing family of Leadership Circle members when you invest $100 a month into the statewide news service you trust at nhpr.org/leaders.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Yesterday, after less than 2 days of deliberation, a jury in Minnesota convicted former police officer Derek Chauvin of the murder of George Floyd, a black man who died after Chauvin used excessive force during an arrest in May of last year. As the country grapples with three recent deaths of black Americans at the hands of police officers, including a black 16-year-old girl shot and killed by police in Ohio around the time the verdict was being read, we today on The Exchange talk about what this conviction means for our country and for New Hampshire. And listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you think justice was served? How are you feeling about this moment and its impact on racism and police reform in New Hampshire? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And our phone number is 800-892-6477. We're talking this hour with James McKim. He's head of the Manchester NAACP. James, welcome. Grateful to have you this morning.
Thank you, Laura. Great to be here.
And we're also joined by Asma El-Houni. She's New Hampshire Movement Politics Director at Rights and Democracy NH. Asma, thank you also for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Camilla Thompson. She's the Youth Outreach Director for Black Lives Matter Seacoast. Camilla, a big welcome and thank you too.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and this all happened yesterday around 5 or 5:30. So we're extra grateful that you were all able to join us on such short notice. First, I just want to ask, how are you doing? Asma, go ahead, please.
Oh, wow. That's a big question. How am I doing? Well, I mean, I think we didn't need to hear a guilty verdict to know that Derek murdered George Floyd. We all seen the video of the murder. And it is important that our nation finally admits it's made a mistake because for way too long it hasn't. But I don't believe that yesterday's verdict is some kind of touchstone or moment of real change in our nation. I'm worried. I'm worried that people will think that justice was served and use it as proof that a system is working, which I do believe the system is working. And the system is working to attack the poor, the black, the brown, the indigenous. And so I caution us not to be so relieved because we're going to continue to hear about brown and black bodies being killed by police. And if anything, I hope this moment is where we start reflecting on what safety really means and if police are the best people to provide that for our communities. And perhaps imagine a world where police were not called in the first place.
Camilla, how about you? How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing good. I am excited about the verdict. I am happy that we got a guilty verdict. I am not going to lie. I was really thinking it was not going to be guilty. I thought we were going to have a not guilty and we were going to have to prepare for protesting and et cetera, et cetera. I think that this also is not really justice. I think it's just a step forward. I think Derek Chauvin is just being held accountable, which is important. But I agree, this is not going to be the last killing. This is not going to be the last trial of a black or brown body. So I think we just need to prepare. I think that we celebrate now. But the work's not done. We still have a lot to do.
James, go ahead, please. How are you feeling doing this morning?
I am cautiously optimistic. And I say that because as both Esma and Camilla said, it's absolutely wonderful that the verdict was rendered in the way that it was. It shows that the system can work, but we still got a long way to go. And I was just reading the New York Times this morning, and Philip Stinson from Bowling Green State had an article discussion about this is one in 2,000. He's captured 2,000 situations where police have killed black or brown bodies. And this is the one that returned a verdict of guilty for the police mm-hmm. officer. So we've got a long way to go. And it's mixed emotions today.
We asked our listeners, was justice served? And they had the same sort of reactions that you all are sharing. Richard said, has justice been served? Will be answered at the sentencing hearing for this former police officer and the nation. Richard says, for me, it's on hold. John writes, this won't bring George Floyd back, but hopefully it will deter this kind of police criminality in the future. This is one step, but it needs to be followed by many more. We need to reduce the shield the police operate under. If they break the law, they need to suffer the consequences. John says we need to retrain them and supervise them in a way that avoids this kind of behavior in the future, not just penalize such grievous actions by white police on people of color in the future. And Aaron also responded to that question, was justice served? Aaron says, yesterday's guilty verdicts were a relief that basic justice might be met in the most egregious circumstances with incontrovertible evidence. But, Aaron says, they do not indicate we have arrived at real, reliable justice for all. As we were waiting with bated breath for the verdict, a troubled 16-year-old child holding only a knife was shot 4 times. All of us, Aaron says, listening to the news, had a pretty good idea that she turned out to be black. Until this changes, we cannot rest. Black Lives Matter cannot only be a cry of grief after yet another death at the hands of those paid to protect us all. And Richard, John, and Aaron, thank you for writing in. Camille, I'm struck by what Aaron says. Black Lives Matter cannot only be a cry of grief after yet another death. How does that sort of ring to you, Camilla?
It's a lot. So I've been working with Black Lives Matter for almost about a year. I grew up on the Seacoast, Black, of course, in a very predominantly white town of Exeter. So when I hear those things and when I think about what the work that we've been doing in the last year, it's almost kind of like, I kind of want to make the ugh kind of noise. It's just kind of like another stab in the back. You know, a lot of people think that when you say Black Lives Matter, it means, you know, Black lives over any other lives, or it means that we hate the police, and we don't hate the police as we would call on them to in emergency circumstances. But I'm not going to lie, I think the Black community in itself is hesitant for reasons just as yesterday with this 15-year-old girl. It is astonishing that I think it was almost to the time. I think we got a verdict at 4:30, and I think I read reports that she was shot and killed at 4:30. So we technically didn't even make it 30 minutes while we were celebrating a victory, and here we are starting at the start line again. So it's hard to hear, but I get, you know, I guess we just keep pushing forward.
Well, and to that sort of, as you said, Camilla, that was a sentiment that a lot of people expressed at a Black Lives Matter vigil in Manchester on Saturday. This was organized by chapters from around the state, and it was held obviously Saturday, so that was before the verdict, but held after the recent killings of more Black Americans by police, Dante Wright and Adam Toledo. I want to play a little bit from Erica Perez. She's co-founder of BLM Manchester.
We have lost so many people. We've been losing people for years. And I don't remember when I started to read the news. I don't remember when I started to pay attention. But we're losing our family. And that's really what it is that we're losing our family. And they're dying. And people care, but it's temporary. So I'm talking to my people of color right now. and I'm specifically talking to my Black people right now. I need you to rest when you get home. I need you to take a minute for yourself. I need you to make sure that you eat a warm meal. And I need you to talk to somebody who you care about, who cares about you and understands you. Because this is not for them. And we're not gonna fix this right now. And we're not gonna fix this in a day. So it's okay to take that second for yourself. Because you deserve it.
Again, that's Erica Perez at a Black Lives Matter vigil in Manchester on Saturday. And James McKim, you know, you hear her just feeling kind of overwhelmed by these continued killings. You were at the vigil, and I wonder just what you think.
Oh, it was Erica's comments were similar to those of other speakers at the event, and there was this sense of exhaustion at continually having to live in a Black brown skin in this nation. And I also just kept thinking about how much we talk so much about what Black bodies have lost. There's a cost for white bodies in this too. And it's the cost of shame, of guilt. And we don't talk about that enough, I think, either. And I think it was great that Erica took the time to say to the Black and brown bodies there, it's okay to take a break. Because it's so important as we can't stop in this fight. Just by our appearance, we're always in it. We're always having to be careful and cognitive and sensitive to what's going on around us and how we present ourselves. So it was just very powerful, but I can't also help but thinking that we don't talk enough about the cost to white bodies of this horrible sin, this original sin that we have in this country.
Asma, what conversations have you been having with friends and family, you know, during the trial, maybe around the vigil, about what the trial was like, what you expected? I'd just love to get a window on sort of the conversations that you've been having with people.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Honestly, the majority of the conversations I've been having is around policing as a system, as an institution itself, because policing has a very problematic history that continues to this day. And so why are we continuously relying on this system for safety? We know that in the South, the historical roots were in slave patrols, who basically enforced slave codes, right? Everyone was meant to contribute, and those who didn't were basically fined. And so it was a genius plan to get white non-slaveholders in the South to align themselves with the slaveholders. And then in the North, we had policing, which was a critical feature in like establishing a racial hierarchy among even whites. And they did that by giving some white people a little more value than others. And those who were assigned that higher value would police the other white generation of immigrants, right? And the function of police is to control basically essential workers in the early centuries of this country, basically. So the people at the bottom of the economic hierarchy were meant to be policed, right? They were expected to build the infrastructure, and the police were there to make sure that these outgroups made, you know, minimum freedom. They got minimum freedom beyond what was required to do their job. So basically, the police, the poor, and it had to do with, you know, the criminal activity. It did not have to do with criminal activity, rather, but it had more to do with policing racial groups, political enemies, corruption. And then we had the Great Migration in the 1800s. And now policing takes on a new set of norms. So we're borrowing from the Metropolitan Police Act, which was in London, And their emphasis was on crime prevention and control of communities, their strategies to maintain strong visibility by patrolling the streets, right? The militaristic structure with the uniforms and ranks now and code of command and discipline. And the first Police Brutality Commission, 1894, it was the first major investigation of police violence. And they issued 300 subpoenas. They call in 600 witnesses. They produced 10,000 pages of testimony. And they use this term, the third degree, to describe maybe what we call today police violence, right? And in the end, they charged 45 counts of assault to the second degree. It was a pretty important moment in policing. And today we are two generations, at least the most two generations. And knowing there is, you know, unmistakable evidence that there's something wrong with the way police functions in our society. And then other things were happening at the time. Many European immigrants were organizing around labor activities, challenging the inequity of the age. There was strikers challenging companies, steel workers, coal miners, and police began to establish red squads, right? And they were sent
to go after union groups. Is that what you're saying, Asma?
Correct. That's right.
Yeah. And this history, and I'm familiar with it, you know, immigrant groups, newer groups as they came in, being policed more heavily and so forth. And then, you know, as they get more established, some of them actually become police officers. And it's fascinating. How does this history that you described, Asma, sort of frame the way you see things today, right now?
Yeah. So basically, what we're trying to say is the institution of policing is flawed. And when we're talking about safety, we keep talking about, you know, oh, it's a great system, we just have bad apples. And what I'm trying to say is, no, it's not just about bad apples, right? Because the bad apples know the system is messed up fundamentally at its core. And so even what we call the good apples, there were no good apples, because where were the good apples who watched George Floyd died and the many brown and black bodies that continue to die in our country? They did not speak up. They did not stop the violence. And so what we're trying to say, at least what some prison abolitionists and police abolitionists are trying to say, is we need to move away from a system of policing, because we keep each other safe and policing is not going to do that for us.
That's definitely something that we'll talk about in just a moment. I want to remind our listeners that we are looking at your reaction here in the Granite State to this significant trial and the guilty verdict on all three counts against former police officer Derek Chauvin in the killing of George Floyd. Listeners, we always want your thoughts. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call, 800-892-6477. Again, 800-892-6477. All of you have mentioned, you know, the killings that just happened this month of Black people at the hands of police. Not only the girl yesterday, Makaya Bryant, but also the 13-year-old Black teenager Adam Toledo. He was shot by a police officer in Chicago while his hands were in the air. And Dante Wright, a Black man who was shot by police officer Kim Potter at a traffic stop in suburban Minneapolis. James, to you first, please. How did this sort of affect for you what was happening in that courtroom with Derek Chauvin?
Well, it's really hard to tell what effect it was having actually in the courtroom itself. I think the impact was more around the way the country was viewing what was happening in the courtroom. I don't have any insights into the actual courtroom proceedings, but I can imagine that the folks who were in the court and the jurors certainly were aware of what was going on. And that, I suspect, weighed on their minds that there's evidence is just so overwhelming now that we have a systemic issue.
Sorry, maybe I didn't ask the question well. What I was trying to say was, and I think you're starting to go there, is how did sort of knowing about these events in Chicago and again in Minneapolis while this trial was going on, how did that weigh on you in terms of the way that you followed this trial?
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that is a different question.
Yes, it is.
So for me, it's about it, as Esma was talking, the systemic nature of things. And also just thinking about the location, the difference in location there in Minneapolis and here in New Hampshire. We are a different state than most states in the United States. And the way that policing is done here follows similar standards and guidelines, but relationships are different. And I've had the honor and pleasure of knowing many of the officers here in the state of New Hampshire and the leadership. And I know that they are truly interested in police forces and law enforcement that is fair. I think the challenge, as Esma really pointed out, is our systems. Our systems, our policies and procedures, and as you know, we spent all summer on the LEAD Commission examining this very issue. Our systems are designed based on the history of policing, but also not so that the personal element is taken out of the equation. The individual decisions of officers and the discretion that they have is allowed in the system. And so until we can have the system ensure that the people who are law enforcement agents have that arrest authority, are going to act properly, and that there are checks and balances that will act properly, we have to make sure the system gets changed.
Wow, that's the perfect segue, James, for what we're going to talk about after a very short break. We're going to look more at New Hampshire reaction to the trial, but just what you said, James, sort of looking more specifically at policies here in the Granite State, including that police reform commission that you served on. So lots more to talk about after a short break. And Exchange listeners, of course, we want to hear from you by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or with a phone call to 800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're hearing local reaction to the verdict in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who was found guilty in the murder of George Floyd. Floyd's death almost a year ago sparked protests last summer and focused national and New Hampshire attention on racial justice in policing and across society. Listeners, we always like to hear from you. Share your thoughts and concerns. How are you feeling about this moment, its impact on police reform and wider racism here in our state? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with James McKim, head of the Manchester NAACP, along with Asma El-Houni. She's the New Hampshire Movement Politics Director at Rights and Democracy NH, and Camilla Thompson. She's the Youth Outreach Director for Black Lives Matter Seacoast. And all of you, more reaction from our listeners. Again, to the question we put before them, was justice served? Rhiannon in Keene says, yes, I feel justice was served, and I'm very proud of the jurors in this case for sending a message to every U.S. law enforcement officer and to the world that in this nation, police can't murder citizens without consequences. Rhiannon says, it's so important we set that example, show the difference between life in a democracy and the gross cruelty and injustice under authoritarian regimes. Abby and Keene writes, there's a long road ahead for Chauvin's guilty verdicts to approximate justice for the ongoing violence against Black lives, but they do signal a long overdue accountability. And Judy in Springfield emailed, I did not dare give into the hope that Mr. Chauvin would be convicted. I've seen too many police officers not held accountable for their actions and be acquitted. Judy says, I was afraid this would be just one more slap in the face of equity, equality, human decency, and justice. Thank you to those who videoed Mr. Floyd's murder. Thank you to the jurors who upheld justice and Mr. Floyd's humanity, Judy says. I am grateful. And thanks to all of you for writing. Again, listeners, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org, and our phone number is 800-892-6477. Well, here in our own state, as all of you know, organizers have consistently said that New Hampshire is not innocent when it comes to systemic racism and police violence. Before we talk about that, I want to play a clip from Jordan Thompson of Black Lives Matter Nashua. Here he is at that vigil in Manchester on Saturday.
And we show up to this work all year. And we try to work with elected officials. We try to work with local police to bridge gaps, to find common ground, to do reform work. But this system can't be reformed. And we're not here asking to reform. We're here asking for abolition. And we talk about justice. There's no justice in this. Justice isn't another police officer being part of the carceral system. It's not justice.
Again, that's Jordan Thompson at the vigil, the Black Lives Matter vigil in Manchester on Saturday. And all of you, let's talk about the work, as Jordan put it, here in New Hampshire. And Camilla, to you first. Black Lives Matter chapters put out 7 demands last year for gubernatorial candidates in response to the killing of George Floyd, including implicit bias training for all state employees, a new racial equity task force, and so forth. Can you get us up to speed, Camilla, please? What, if any, of these demands have been met?
You know, I'm not sure that all of them have really been met yet. I know that schools in general around our town, I guess around Rockingham County, are really beginning to try to do DEI training, and they're trying to teach more anti-racism stuff. I've noticed that, towns is the right word. Towns are kind of coming together. I think that we have made a stance, and we've made sure that we are here and that we are known. I think we're also applying a lot of pressure. So we have to keep applying the pressure until something happens. So as of right now, I don't think anything has happened, but we're not done yet.
Oh, that's interesting. So, and DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. So it sounds like, Camilla, at the state level, you haven't seen a lot of action on these demands that Black Lives Matter put out. But at the town level, more attention.
Yeah, I think so. I can only talk for Exeter specifically, from personal experience, because I'm there. And I personally had a lot of schools reach out to me, I guess our public schools, that have asked me to kind of sit on some trainings and see where they can help. I think that the problem, though, is that if I'm going to speak bluntly about white folks, is that they have their own agenda. They think that one thing is, you know, one thing. And for Black and brown bodies, we see racism as very out there. And so it's about teaching these towns and these schools that racism is not just something that we can push away, and that it's here. So New Hampshire is really not innocent.
Wow, that's really interesting, Camilla. So give me an example of your frustration there. You said, you know, white people think, as you put it, one thing is one thing. Black and brown people see it differently. Give us an example of what you mean.
So I guess if we want to speak about policing in general, or we want to talk about Black men dying at the hands of the police. I grew up in Exeter. You know, I have many Facebook friends. And so what I read from people around our area is that they find the negative, right? So they see this Black man, not that he's just a person, but that he has an arrest record, or he's on drugs, or he wasn't supposed to be doing this anyway. I hear a lot of that, but I don't see, you know, people saying, oh, this is just a human being. I hear a lot of people saying, you know, white people are killed more than Black people by police. That's great, but the white race is the majority race, right? So when you start killing off the minority, then we have an issue.
What do you think, Asma, about progress or lack thereof right here in New Hampshire, whether to the Black Lives Matter demands that we heard about last year or the Commission on Law Enforcement and Accountability that put out some demands last year as well? What progress, if any, do you see, Asma, here in our state?
Gosh, I don't see progress in terms of police. I think as Jordan, we heard Jordan talk, he said, you can't reform a system that's fundamentally corrupt from its very beginning. And we see that today. So I think when we're talking about looking forward, we need to look to solutions that aren't relying on these punitive systems like policing, like prisons, like jails. And one way to do that, and I know people are afraid of the word abolition, we're not asking tomorrow for this to happen, but we're asking that societies move towards that. And so one way to do that is to defund the police. And it can have several different, you know, ways of doing that. You can one, you can decommission the military equipment given to police by the federal government. Sometimes it's free, sometimes they buy it. There's no need for police officers to have access to tanks, assault rifles, and all this other equipment that they're obtaining from the military to justify even more money to defense contracts. And then we can cut the police budget. And yeah, that means less police. People need to realize that the overwhelming majority of what police officers are doing is responding to things that simply don't need an armed response. And most of these things can be dealt with an unarmed individual trained in different areas, responding, like, for example, requests for information, fire alarms, lost property, abandoned vehicles. All these things can purely be done by administrative roles that just fill out the paperwork, right? When we're talking about theft and burglary, the same thing. It can be filled, you know, they can do the paperwork, a bureaucratic position that takes interviews and fills out paperwork. And then when we're talking about, you know, minor disturbances or disorderly conduct or enforcement of truancy or vandalism, they can all be responded to by social workers, mental health professionals who are already trained in de-escalation and conflict resolution. And when we're talking about responding to drug sales or usage, that should be the primary domain of drug counselors, right? That focus on health-based solutions, right? That have been proven to be successful, right? And so we are overusing police, right? And even, you know, for those things that we think are absolutely needed, right? We can still think of other solutions to that as well. So we need to replace police staff with professionals, and we can do it. There are communities that have already, that are already working towards abolition, where they are not calling police officers, and people can look them up and look at different solutions and how they're going about in their communities. There's critical resistance. You can look them up. You can look up in site. Miriam Kaba has a project that she's running called NIA. So so I think when we're talking about looking forward and the solution, it has to be a world without police.
James, how do you contextualize this conversation? A lot of people have been talking about what Asma said, you know, cut police budgets, transfer that money to, you know, drug addiction, mental illness, you know, reduce the amount of military hardware that police have these days. I'm asking you, not only your role as the head of the NAACP, but also you were a key member of the Commission on Law Enforcement and Accountability, Community and Transparency, often known by its acronym, the LEACT Commission. So what are your thoughts there, James?
So I think that part of me says there's a national view of this. And we have a lot of big cities which have police forces that have grown to be very militaristic. And then we have New Hampshire, where we don't have those kinds of police forces that are extremely militaristic. And so I that's part of what I think about, that dichotomy here, and how do we deal with this issue here in New Hampshire, given what we have? And I think the general approach to policing, we do want to move more toward having the right resources, the right skills, addressing the right issues. And Esma really laid out very well how police should not be handling certain situations. And the law enforcement will actually be the first to tell you this. They know this, but this comes down to us as individual citizens. We don't provide the support and the funding for the resources to be applied where they need to be applied. And then because of that, it all falls on the law enforcement agents. So I think we do need reform. And we actually had spent quite a bit of time on this very topic in the testimony in the hearings over the summer, and looking at having medical professionals be available to be the first to respond to some of these calls that have come in. And you know, we created a report, a 38-page report with 48 recommendations, and the governor endorsed all of them. There was there were executive orders that he put into place to implement as many as he could. There is legislation that was drafted. I was part of the drafting of some of that legislation. SB 96, for example, was one where we tried to, in a bipartisan way, bring forth a bill to implement many of the other recommendations. And I am just so disheartened that we now have going through our legislature bills that are trying to, in essence, negate all of that, those recommendations that we put forth and that we built into legislation. So we have a huge battle that we as individual citizens need to get into to communicate with our legislators and have them know that we want reform. We want a change in the way that the system operates. And we can debate as to whether we should totally abolish the police forces here in New Hampshire. But I think we need to look at New Hampshire as a different state with a different constituency, different demographics, and a different way of being than Atlanta or Minneapolis. And that's the perspective I try to bring to this discussion.
Well, we got an email from a listener, James, Sue in Manchester, who wanted to ask you about that. She says, I'd like to hear from Mr. McKim, who was part of the LEACT Commission, about the recommendations the legislature accepted and turned down SB 96, Sue says, and how that will impact efforts to improve law enforcement in New Hampshire. And further, Sue asks, what are the next steps toward getting more of those recommendations into practice? She also says, thank you for the conversation. You're welcome, Sue. And James, you sort of addressed that, but anything else you want to say there to Sue's point about getting these recommendations into practice? As you said, the governor did what he could by executive order, but there is stuff that has to be done by the legislature.
Right, and that gets back to, as I said, we as citizens need to communicate with our legislators, tell them what we want. And there are other bills that are out there at the federal level, HB 7120, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, would address some of the issues that we tried to raise in SB 96, but we're not able to at the state level. If you look at HB 1271 and SB 470 around the reporting of misconduct and focusing on racial slurs. So there's this legislation that is being put forth, and I'm really disheartened by HB 544 and that language that was placed into the budget that when HB 544 was tabled, that would ban us from even having this discussion.
Well, this goes to the heart of go ahead, James. Sorry.
this goes to the heart of our democracy. If we're not allowed to have a discussion about these issues that we've been taught for so long and we shouldn't because it's not polite to have these discussions, how are we going to improve? How are we going to become a better state, a better nation?
Well, and Sue says that SB 96 was turned down. Actually, just a quick fact check there, Sue. SB 96 was stripped down, but not turned down. So body cams were passed and then data collection was taken out. Thank you for writing, Sue. Lois wrote both about the verdict and about things happening here in our state. Lois says the verdict is a relief and a start, but in a world waking up to the realities of racism and the collective focus on Black Lives Matter, Governor Sununu said recently, there is no systemic racism in New Hampshire. Lois said perhaps he could spend a day or two with a Black or brown family in our state to find out what life is like. Perhaps he could just sit down and talk with a few of the people of color that he must see in a normal week in his life. There is obviously a lot to be learned. I want to turn to you, I think, Camilla, about that first, when the Black Lives Matter protests, you know, were first happening last summer. Sununu said he was supportive, but then he did say yesterday or earlier this week, there is no systemic racism in New Hampshire. So I just like your thoughts on that, Camilla.
To hear that the governor said that there is no systemic racism here in New Hampshire feels like a punch to the gut. As a Black person, as somebody who has a brother, my children's father, I think that he could come to my house and ask us what we think, and he would get a very clear, different explanation. I think it's terrible here, and I think it's terrible because we are a predominantly white state, but that goes hand in hand with what I said. You know, sometimes people don't see what we see. I think that... Sorry, I'm just trying to gather these thoughts here. It was actually very angering to hear. I love to use this phrase that, you know, people need to listen with their mouths closed, but their ears open. I think that people need to take a walk in our shoes. I think that... Oh, goodness. I'm sorry. I'm all over the place because I'm trying not to be angry.
Well,
I'm
and
trying to gather.
There's so much there, Camilla. If you want a moment to gather, I can come back to you on that.
Yeah,
that's fine. And we got a couple emails from listeners who were upset about that statement. Melissa says, I was upset and disturbed that during an NHPR interview earlier this week, Governor Sununu stated that systemic racism does not exist in New Hampshire. Melissa says, so says the white privileged leader of our state. Denial and ignorance will continue to impede our ability to do the real work of holding ourselves accountable to ensuring racial justice and equality. Now, I went back to that interview this morning, and the governor did say, I don't believe systemic racism exists in New Hampshire. He also said, we have elements of racism and implicit bias throughout all parts of our community. And so he said, it's not just a school issue or a law enforcement issue, it's a cultural issue. How does that hit you, Asma? There isn't systemic racism, there's elements of racism and implicit bias throughout all parts of our community. Is that just semantics or is it something more?
It's really sad. I mean, come on, like how in the dark is our governor and why is he governor representing people of color if he doesn't even understand systemic racism? I mean, we know that the Black community makes 1.7% of the population in New Hampshire, yet 7% of the New Hampshire prison and jail population for every 100,000 people, right? The same thing for the Latinx community, they're 4% of the population, 7% of the New Hampshire jail and population. So like, and we know that, look at the governor's COVID-19 equity response team. You can see how COVID has affected people in our state very differently, right? So yes, it does. Systemic racism does affect people in New Hampshire. I don't need to give personal examples, but yeah, when I fly, right? And I'm pulled aside and my fingers and hands are checked for bomb material. That's systemic racism, right? Because I'm a Muslim woman, right? And so he's totally in the dark. And I think that brings back the point that James talked about. We have this bill that New Hampshire is trying to pass, a very dangerous bill, HB 544, that's going to stop these very important conversations that apparently even our governor needs to learn about, because he doesn't even know that systemic racism exists. And how can you address it if you don't even acknowledge that it exists, right? And so I think as a community, we really need to work hard to make sure that we defeat which HB 544, which is now an amendment in HB 2 in the budget, to defeat that, to make sure we can continue having these important conversations, to really live into the, you know, the multiracial democracy that we're all trying to achieve in our nation, where, you know, Black, brown, and white people can thrive.
All right. And I wanted to ask all of you about HB 544. Since James mentioned it earlier, there may be some listeners who aren't quite sure what that is. So we have to take a very quick station break, but we'll return to that in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow it's Earth Day, and we'll learn about efforts around New England to combat climate change. Join us for that conversation Thursday morning, live at 9. Today, New Hampshire reaction to the verdict in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who was found guilty in the murder of George Floyd. Floyd's death almost a year ago sparked nationwide protests, and here in New Hampshire, calls for racial justice in policing and more broadly in our society. Listeners, it's been good to get your reactions to both the trials and some of the issues that have been raised right here in our own state. Keep your comments coming in to exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 800-892-6477. We've been talking with James McKim, head of the Manchester NAACP, along with Asma Elhouni, New Hampshire Movement Politics Director at Rights and Democracy NH, and Camilla Thompson, the Youth Outreach Director for Black Lives Matter Seacoast. And Camilla, before the break, both Asma and James were expressing their frustration with this bill that used to be House Bill 544. Now it's in the budget, as you know. This would prevent schools from teaching about systemic racism. The governor has said he will veto this. He does not think it's a good idea. I wonder, Camilla, you mentioned earlier, you know, your hopes at the local level, that you do see interest in this type of education. So just your broad thoughts, please, on this whole discussion underway about HB 544.
I think it's silly because I think, you know, when we say like New Hampshire is not innocent, I believe how we tackle racism can be taught. So where we start is where we start in schools, right? We start with our teachers. We start with these trainings. We start with talking about more Black history, because Black history is our history. So, I mean, we need these things in our school. And if New Hampshire is really, you know, a live free or die straight and we're progressive and all these other things, we need to talk about these things and not shy them away.
Well, we got an email from Bill who says, yes, a guilty verdict was rendered. Yes, we can be relieved for the moment, but right here in New Hampshire, the same systemic racism that makes this verdict such an anomaly seems to be beyond comprehension by many members of our legislature, which ignored key recommendations of the Law Enforcement Accountability, Community and Transparency, or LEACT Commission, which one of your guests was actually a member of. And Bill also mentions a bill being considered right now would make diversity education within schools and businesses illegal in the state. Until we all acknowledge, he says, and begin to deal with systemic racism in the Granite State, we won't have racial justice and harmony. And again, that bill is now part of the House budget. The governor has said he does not like it, but it gets a little tricky when it's part of the budget. So we'll have to see what happens around that. I wanted to ask all of you about going back to Minnesota and what happened there. But I'm going to ask you this to relate it to New Hampshire. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, responding to the conviction yesterday, saying the work of our generations is to put an end to the vestiges of Jim Crow and centuries of trauma and finally put an end to racism. And Ellison said it's time to transform the relationship between community and the people who are sworn to protect them from one that is mistrustful, suspicious, and in some cases terrifying, into one that is empathetic, compassionate, and affirming. Again, that's Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison. What are your thoughts there, James? What is it going to take to make that transformation that he talks about?
Well, I think first of all, it's a cultural shift. It's going to take our culture changing. It's going to take lots and lots of education. It's going to take opportunities for people from different backgrounds to work together toward a positive goal. That's what changes culture and our individual, our beliefs and values. And we have to face the fact that our organizations are made up of people. So if people don't believe in a value system where everyone is valued, we codify through policies and procedures the behavior that we expect. And that codification, be it in policies and procedures or laws, can be overtly or covertly, and is in many cases covertly, in many cases overtly discriminatory. So I think it's going to take us really taking a hard look at who we are, telling the truth about who we are, proclaiming the dream of who we'd like to be, repairing the breach of what's happened, the breach that is our original sin of this nation, and practicing the way of love and kindness and empathy. We have to turn to that way of being if we're going to make any progress.
Towards that end, people working together, I do want to play another clip from Jordan Thompson, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Nashua. This again is from the vigil in Manchester on Saturday, organized by chapters from around the state. Here's Jordan Thompson.
Y'all will show up to these vigils and you'll tweet Black Lives Matter and, oh, I've met with Black Lives Matter and I love them, they're great. But when it's time to vote the way that we ask you to vote, it's silence. Or y'all vote the wrong way. And we're tired because we tried. I want y'all to hear that we tried with you. We tried for a year. And we are still here.
Again, that's Jordan Thompson with Black Lives Matter Nashua. And Camilla, just to wrap up, what do you hope comes out of this moment that we're at now for the future of the state? I mean, here we are having this conversation again.
I hope that we move forward. I am really hesitant to think that we've really made a change just yet. I agree with everything that Jordan said in his speech. You know, people, it's almost kind of like when, you know, this whole thing with George Floyd, right? It's been happening. These Black men are dying, but somebody got a good camera angle, right? And as grateful as the entire country is that she got this great camera angle, now everyone is kind of like, oh my gosh, this is happening. But for Black and brown bodies, we've kind of been like, this has been happening. And it felt like a slap in the face. So I hope that this energy continues, and I hope people listen, and I hope people don't just, you know, show up to our protest or tweet Black Lives Matter because we just got a guilty verdict, because we're about to start this race again, right? We're about to try to demand justice for this 15-year-old girl that just died, and for the next person that dies next month, and the person that dies next year. We're going to continue to do this, but the energy needs to be the same. Don't just show up because it looks good on Instagram and on Facebook, or you look cool because you're, you know, supporting Black Lives Matter. Actually be a part of the change.
Asma, what's your hope?
Yeah, my hope is that we do live in a world where we're not using punitive systems, and instead we're relying on community solutions. But also, we can't forget the value of policy. And so it's really important that when we're talking about policy, there are several things that we can focus on in New Hampshire. On the federal level, we need to contact our members of Congress and demand that they vote yes for the BREATHE Act, right? And the BREATHE Act is centered around divesting from the brutal system of policing and reinvesting in alternative ways of public safety. So that's what we can do on the national level by contacting our members of Congress. And then locally, we have, like I said, this we absolutely need to be fighting bills or amendments now, like HB 2, that basically sounds great on face value. Like anyone reading that, that's the genius of these things. Like if you read the bill, who would oppose an individual shouldn't be discriminated against based on their race or sex, right? This is directly language from the bill, right? And what's really happening is this bill or this amendment is literally stopping the very things it's claiming to do. And it's not acknowledging that those things currently exist in our structures. And so essentially they're saying, by pointing out that there is a, you know, greater access for certain groups of people, or that because of skin color alone, some people get lighter sentences, right? Or get pain medication in hospitals, or allowed to live in other cases, right? To name that, we're called racist and sexist. And essentially that's what this bill is trying to do, shut down those conversations. And I don't know if people know, like, this is going to affect our hospitals. It's going to affect teaching.
Wow,
right?
Asma. Oh, I feel so bad cutting you off.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have to, and I do apologize because our hour is up. But that sounds like something that we need to follow up on here in the Exchange. Not an easy conversation today. I very much appreciate everybody being with us. Today's show was a team effort, but that team was led by our senior producer, Christina Phillips. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.